music. I say it's made a kind of.
Chris Hedges, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, heard globally at kpfk.org.
The program that you're about to hear is a rebroadcast and has previously aired here on KPFK.
There are over a million lawyers. They're called part of the legal profession. Where have they been? The bar associations don't speak out. The American Bar Association, the biggest bar association in the world, they don't take a stand. They're the first responders. They're supposed to be our sentinels. They're AWOL. The organized church that used to sustain the norms, they collapsed. Gambling is everywhere now, right down at fingertips for a teenager in his or her bedroom can gamble. That's collapsed. On many fronts, they were in the forefront of the civil rights movement, the peace movement. Where are they now? In fact, the evangelical groups in the South are just opposite. They're for war. They're for destruction of Palestinian rights. They love Donald J. Trump. It's just the opposite. The labor unions have never been weaker. There's a few surges in partial organization at Starbucks and Starbucks and Amazon and others, of course. But the number of unionized workers still going down. It's the lowest in 80, 90 years. I think only about 10% of all workers now, public and private, together are organized. And they're headed by often very cautious leaders who every time we propose to them to join with consumer environmental forces, pass it by the Democratic Party apparatus that turns it down. So they're like a tail of the Democratic Party. The civic groups, they're totally outnumbered. They can't keep up with all the opposition. Just in terms of people, you know, number of lobbyists on Capitol Hill, litigators, they're struggling for funds. So you can see the media, of course, who just finished talking, they have cut the ground under the citizen movement and the citizen community, and that's basically why the Democrats lost election after election, including the one last November, because the civic groups. Are groups that know how to talk to people at the grassroots. They don't differentiate between conservative workers and liberal workers for health and safety, or conservative patients and liberal patients for health and safety, or consumers. They don't do that. They talk to all people, and they know the language. They know the strategies and the tactics. They were completely blocked by the Democratic Party from any input. Why? Because few people know this. The Democratic Party not only is wallowing in corporate PAC money, they have contracted out their campaigns to corporate conflicted political and media consultants who raise the money, develop the strategy, generate the taboos, and block us from input into the Democratic Party at the national, state, and local level. And that blockage kept the Democratic Party from taking the most obvious positions that could have won easily the House, Senate, and the presidency last year. For example, they could have made a big deal out of a frozen federal minimum wage of $7.25. That's 25 million workers would get a raise to $15 an hour. And they didn't do it. Kamala Harris just made a throwaway line. They didn't listen to Bernie Sanders, for example. They could have increased benefits of Social Security, which have been frozen for 50 years. Instead, they said, we'll protect Social Security as it is now. About 65 million people would have gotten higher Social Security benefits. They could have defeated the Republicans on the child tax credit extension. 61 million kids from conservative liberal families were getting an average of $300 a month. It cut poverty almost in half among children in the United States. And they didn't do that. Instead, Kamala Harris sent her brother-in-law to Wall Street to talk to Goldman Sachs and corporate law firms to advise her on her economic and tax policy. And her most memorable phrase is opportunity economy. Well, that really spells specifics to put food on people's table. So basically, the Democratic Party owes America a huge apology in maybe 10 installments of how they sabotaged the only party that could have saved the Republic from the fascism and the corporatism and the militarism of the GOP. Instead, the Democratic Party became part of the problem. They also were militaristic, they were corporatistic, and they weren't all that great in terms of opening the channels of government to civic input. And so they had an autocratic dimension as well.
I just want to, before we go on, talk about the conspiracy or the collusion between the two parties to shut down third parties. I mean, you were a victim of that.
Yes. Well, you know, it's what I call the two-party duopoly, which has been picked up as a phrase. And if you don't have a competitive democracy, you don't have a democracy. And if they shut off third-party efforts by huge ballot access barriers, by avalanche of frivolous lawsuits diverting resources and time from these little parties, you're not going to get what you got in the 19th century, where you had the Liberty Party created in 1840 against slavery, you had the Women's Suffrage Party, you had the labor, progressive, farmer parties. They all pushed the two parties into taking up these positions after some years or decades, even though they never won a national election. It was much easier in the 19th, early 20th century to get on the ballot. But when the Communist Party started running candidates in the U.S., the ballot barriers by state law after state law became horrendous. In fact, in one state of California, there's more signatures required to get on the ballot to run for president than in, you know, 10 Western European countries. In Canada, it's very easy to get on the ballot. So what happened was they violated a law of nature. Imagine if seeds were not allowed to sprout in nature. What would be left of our biosphere? What would be left of our biota? And that's what they've done. And as a result, the corporatists found that they could make the two parties come to become more and more alike. And to have one party justify doing bad things by saying, don't you know how bad the Republicans are? What are you criticizing us? The Republicans are worse. So they define each other by who's the worst instead of who's the best. And we're paying the price now in wars of empire, in the domination of corporate supremacists over everything. They're raising our children with that iPhone 5-7 hours a day, undermining parental authority, separating these children from family, community, nature, harming their health with junk food and sedentary living, with very little kids playing outside anymore. And there isn't anything that corporate commercialism now has not invaded. They've commercialized the churches. They've commercialized they've commercialized the academic world. They've commercialized almost everything outside the marketplace. They see as a profit center. So they want to corporatize the post office. They want to take over public drinking water departments and corporatize them. They want to corporatize the public school system one way or the other. They want to corporatize the public lands or take the public lands. And they've never been more aggressive, never been more successful. And the civic community, which used to be relied on to resist, can't get any media. And we have tried. Last year, we made a major effort to turn Labor Day into a real workers' day with events all over the country. We got the unions behind us, the AFL behind us. They're ready to roll out in July. It would have been a tremendous phenomena. It would have energized people to go to vote in November. And it was based around a compact for American labor, protecting their pensions, living wage, health insurance, right to organize, and so on. And just as we were going to get underway, Liz Shuler and others passed the proposal by the Democratic National Committee, and they shut it down, saying they couldn't control what was going to be said or done at these local media events and gatherings. And Mark Dimenstein, the head of the Postal Workers Union, who was very excited about this idea and persuaded the FFL Council on 16th Street, next to the White House, to pick it up. He said, that's what the unions do all the time. Anything that deals with political, they just write blank checks to the Democratic PACs, no strings attached, they don't demand anything, and any proposal by an outsider is passed by the Democratic National Committee. Well, that alone elected Trump and the Congress. Just that shutdown of the civic community alone, and I include the labor unions as part of that, would have made the difference. You know, Trump was elected by a margin of 235,000 votes just in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin combined. In other words, if there was a 240,000 vote switch, he would have been defeated. So that's just one example. And in 2022, we mobilized 24 national citizen groups for a Zoom conference of 6 hours for candidates running for office at the national and state level. And they all delivered 10, 15-minute concise presentations. You know, they know what they're talking about, strategies, tactics, policies, language, rebuttals, slogans, and ways to get out the vote. And it was almost entirely ignored. And Nancy Pelosi couldn't be bothered to tell her legions in the Democratic Party to show up on the Zoom conference in July 2022. Anybody who wants to see what we did, it's on winningamerica.net, and winningamerica.net. And again, that would have broadened the progressive participation and majority in Congress and would have set the stage to defeat Trump in 2024. So basically, when you shut out the civic community, Chris, you shut down democracy. And I place the responsibility not just on the Democratic Party, but first and foremost on the mass media. And it was impossible to get any coverage of the July conference. These are major groups represented. Didn't get any ink whatsoever. Couldn't get anybody other than Dana Milbank. He wrote a column for the Washington Post to cover our nine-month effort to inject the civic community into the dialogue and into the discussion of the 2022 elections. And the same thing happened. We couldn't get a single column on this effort on Labor Day. Not a single column in any of the mainstream press. And by the way, Chris, the independent press is not such a hot shot either. The magazines like In These Times, Washington Monthly, Progressive Magazine, The Nation, they don't cover civic community activities. They just pontificate. They do have some good articles, and they have their columnists, many of whom are getting very tired and repetitive. They don't cover what Public Citizen, Common Cause, Pension Rights Center, Center for Science, Public Interest, Union of Concerned Scientists. Veterans for Peace especially gets completely blacked out regardless of their demonstrations and nonviolent civil disobedience all over the country against the military machine, the empire, the weaponization of the genocide in Gaza. They haven't had a single article. They put out all kinds of great material. People can go to veteransforpeace.org and see for yourself. These are veterans who've known wars, and they can't even get any coverage. And you can't get any coverage of the lack of coverage. You can't get the journalism publications to do any coverage of the censorship. So this is the ultimate censorship, the shutdown of the First Amendment. When the press, which is given a cachet in the First Amendment, there's no other industry mentioned by name in the Constitution, are abusing their privileges for a mess of pottage. They're abusing them for the profits they want to make from advertising, which, of course, begins to replace journalists and editors who want to do the right thing with journalists and editors who got their finger to the wind and are worried about the money before reporting the truth in an equitable fashion. And it even gets worse. The Times created Trump. They kept giving him more and more publicity. They created J.D. Vance. Whoever heard of J.D. Vance? They kept writing about his book. They kept writing about his Senate race more than the opponent, Tim Ryan, in the U.S. Senate race in Ohio. The same with all these other people. 11 pages in three editions to Tucker Carlson. They gave Tucker Carlson more ink and didn't lay a glove on him, by the way. All they did was publicize who he was. He loved it. He held up the papers to promote it. And they gave him more space than any figure in the history of the New York Times. And whoever heard of Marjorie Taylor Greene from an obscure district in Georgia, until the Times started reporting her every ugly utterance and put her on the cover of the New York Times magazine.
But before we close, I want to end by talking about what we have to do. I just want you to talk about the crackdown on college campuses, including your alma maters of Princeton and Harvard Law School. I find it quite disturbing. Universities should be, sacrosanct in terms of free speech. And having covered despotic governments all over the world, once they shut down that university space, it's quite ominous.
Yes. It was made even worse by the October 7th and thereafter, where the attack on October 7th was a homicide-suicide mission. They lost 1,600 Hamas fighters, more than the alleged number of Israelis who were killed, 350 of whom were soldiers, by the way. And that was a raid into Israel that can't compare with the raids into Palestine for 60 years, slaughtering from the air all kinds of civilians and civilian infrastructures again and again and again against a defenseless population, as Gideon Levy, the columnist in Haaretz, wrote about again and again, among other columnists in that newspaper in Israel. And then the eruption of protest on college campuses, I would never have guessed the level of suppression, suspending students, discharging students, shutting down events, suspending potential grants, blocking professors from moving from one university to another, including one of the nation's leading experts on genocide, Mr. Professor Siegel from Stockton University, at a post at University of Minnesota, which was turned down because he was outspoken about the genocide in Gaza. The law schools are following suit. The law firms, some of them have announced they will not hire or they will reject job offers of law school graduates who were involved in pro-Palestinian rights activities at law school opposed to genocide. I mean, who would ever have dreamed something like that? Even critics of universities never dreamed the level of cowardliness, the level of receptiveness to a few large donors who were pro-Israeli government can do no wrong enthusiasts. And it cowed Harvard University, Princeton, and others decisively, just proving our point that at academic institutions, money talks more than truth, more than freedom of speech. And the answer to it is just better organizing on campus with smarter strategies. I wouldn't have spent all that time on disinvestment. There are other ways that can affect universities much more deeply that have to be considered. And these students need a few full-time people helping them at these large universities, because these students got to deal with classes and grades. So there needs to be more resources around, and brave faculty have to be defended. You have to have pro bono lawyers. And with the right tactics and strategies, you can tip the balance in favor of freedom of speech and developing the civic refinements for justice as part of the educational process itself.
Well, I know I want to move on to what we have to do, but I know you've talked about mobilizing alumni as kind of a key aspect of pushing back against the suppression of free speech and the suspension of students and the kind of blacklisting of those who speak out on the campus. But let's just close by, what do we do now? We are on the cusp of an American fascism. There's just no way around it. You know, reading these executive orders, everything from education to revoking student visas for foreign students who have participated in protests against the genocide. I mean, it's a long list. What do we do now to save what's left of our open society?
Well, there's a lot that has to be done in order to create the brooks that feed the streams, that feed the tributaries, that feed the Mississippi River, to take a metaphor, to its limit. For example, there's nothing stopping students from organizing their own full-time groups with full-time staff. They can assess themselves $15-$20 a student and do what the public interest research groups have done on domestic issues all over the country with full-time staff. We have to expand our language. We should never use words like white-collar crime. It's corporate crime. We should use words like corporatism, not private sector. We've got to organize, as you say, the progressive alumni. There's always significant percentages of progressive alumni of these schools, but they don't know each other, and that has to be connected. We've got to beef up the student press, which is very heavily on trivia and sports.
But in a broader sense, outside of the universities.
Yeah, in a broader sense, all it comes down to are two things. Trump will self-destruct because he knows no boundaries. So his greatest enemy is Trump. And you will see the unraveling of Trump in the succeeding weeks. I would not be surprised that if he continues his bull in the china shop, illegal, wild flailing, affecting tens of millions of people in terms of their dire necessities of life in favor of his corporate supremacists, that he will be impeached and convicted in the U.S. Senate. His own party will turn against him, because when they see the polls, which are already dropping since January 20th, by the way, when they see the polls and they realize it's either them or Trump, they will always take their own political survival, just as a few senators did during the Nixon Watergate scandal, when they got into a limousine and went to the White House and basically said to Nixon, your time is up. You've lost your base in Congress. So the second is we've got to focus on the Congress. That is the leading fulcrum for turning around the U.S. government, foreign, domestic, and affecting state and local. That's what the founders believed when they gave the most powerful authorities by far, not to the executive branch or the judicial branch, but to Congress, the exclusive power to declare war, to exercise the taxing power, the spending power, the nomination confirmation power, and the investigative oversight authority. And so we're down to 535 men and women. Probably 20% of them are already on the side of truth and justice and peace. And we've got to organize back home. My best guess is 1% of the people organized in congressional districts, that's 2.5 million, and progressive districts who represent public opinion, who know what they're talking about, who are willing to put in, say, 500 hours a year of volunteer time, about the time people put in on a hobby, and who will raise enough money for an office with 2 full-time staff in each congressional district, can defeat the corporate supremacists and take control of Congress and turn the country around. That is quite a bit of organizing, but most people would not believe that 1% can do it. We did it in the 60s and early 70s with far less than 1% to regulate these companies. Remember, when it comes down to the brass tacks, the members of Congress want your vote far more than they want money from commercial interests. They want money from commercial interests in order to defeat their opponent, put ads on TV. Why? Because they want to get votes. But if the votes are conditioned and focused, and if members of Congress are regularly summoned to town meetings back home where the citizenry sets the agenda and asks the questions, and the senators and representatives respond and listen and go back to their instructions, the country can be changed. We should always remember that when it comes down to where people live, work, and raise their children, there are not the kind of polarizations that the rulers try to inculcate on the public. Divide and rule goes back over 2,000 years as a tactic. Most of the necessities of life are supported by an overwhelming number of Americans, regardless of the labels they put on themselves, conservative, liberal, or whatever. Living wage is one, universal health insurance is two, crackdown on corporate crooks is three, a fair tax system is four, debloating the military budget and coming back home to repair and modernize infrastructure and public services in every community, creating a lot of jobs is five, and empowering people so that they can take back their sovereign power and condition it before they give their instructions back to their senators or their state legislators or their city council person. So it's not an impossible task. It has precedence in American history, and it's surprising when people realize what a tiny percentage of active, engaged citizens representing public opinion, knowing what they're talking about, and making direct contact with town meetings with their representatives. No flacks, no intermediaries. We have all kinds of books that show how this can be done, how it has been done. One of them is called Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think, that I wrote. And another one is called Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. It's good to know history and the successes from history so we don't get discouraged and demoralized as we see so much of that today in the U.S.
Great. Thank you so much, Ralph. I want to thank Sophia, Diego, Thomas, and Max, who produced the show. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
And I might add, keeping it up to date, I have a weekly column since 1971. You can get free electronically at nader.org. Just go to it, sign up, and you'll be kept up to date on what we're doing and thinking.